All right, Tim, are you ready to do this? Maybe we should
I can't wait for you to go, welcome to Cinema with Fudgas. I don't even remember the way you enter it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cinema Faith podcast for February 2022. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I am joined for the first time in over 2 years by the one and only Tim Nelson. That's right, Tim. This is our first podcast in a long time. Our last time together was December of 2019.
Oh, my gosh. Pre-COVID.
Yes. It was on The Irishman. And it is now February 2022, over 2 years later. So
it's like we were like in a time machine or something. The world has changed.
Yeah, not much has changed since then, right? Pretty much same old, same old. Oh,
it's
wait,
all the same.
Everything has changed. I feel like a totally different person. I do. I remember I was talking to you a few weeks ago, and we were like kind of just trying to get back in the groove of how we're going to do this. And I was talking about something that, like, you said, you've never shared that with me before. And I thought about it. And I was like, you're right. I was kind of like hesitant to share that before. And it just came out like, no problem. I feel like, I don't know. It's sort of like when you're losing weight and no one around you can tell because they just live with you every day. And then you meet someone you haven't met in a long time. They're like, what happened to you? That's how it is. That's COVID. I feel like we're going to all stumble out of our houses and people are going to be like, you're totally different.
No, it's been kind of rough. Everybody's been inside. It's almost like as we're kind of the Omicron's caressing right now, we want to be, it's like when everyone wants to get back out, we're like going back into the podcasting, which is kind of weird, but you know what? Good.
It feels like the right time.
Yeah, it does. It feels good.
Yeah.
And then maybe everybody caught up on all the past episodes. I don't know.
Hopefully. People are still downloading the show, which is just like mind-boggling to me, but God bless them. Thank you. Thank you. So hopefully now that we can get some fresh content out in the world, we'll get our listeners back. I know it's been a long road.
Can we talk a little bit about the long road for a sec? I know you got a pretty tight schedule.
No. But I want to. I think it's only fair, right? I want to do a little recap of kind of our lives since our listeners last heard us. But like, obviously we'll keep it as brief as possible. But I mean, it's been a long time. So our last show was The Irishman, and gosh, all I remember about that movie is those terrible blue CGI eyes from Robert De Niro and those flashbacks. Just the worst. Do you remember that?
Yes, but barely, because it's been 2 years.
It's been 2 years.
Yeah, I remember that it really bothered you.
It really upset me. Anyway, so that was that. That was our last show. And then we decided to take a couple months off because I was doing the Oscar thing, you know, that I always do. This was the beginning of 2020. And then I did that. Oscars came and went. I did all my write-ups. And then it was March 2020 is when everything changed. So, Tim, start with this. What do you remember as far as like the moment that you knew COVID was actually a big deal and it was going to like affect your life? Do you remember that moment?
Yeah, sure. I was a hospital chaplain. So they pulled us immediately from the hospitals.
So they said,
we don't know what this is yet. You know, and there was no test even yet. It was just crazy. And so they were like, if they have the symptoms, don't go in. Yeah, it was kind of nutty. So I was not even halfway through my hospital chaplaincy residency, and yeah, we got pulled. And it really changed everything. So I'm doing remote chaplaincy for a while, and then eventually went back in.
Okay.
And it was one of these deals. I remember everybody started buying toilet paper. I mean, people have been there. They're tired of it.
I remember the toilet paper incident. Yeah, I went to a gas station to fill up, and there were rolls, individual rolls you could buy there. And I was like, so wait, there's no limit? Like, I can just take as many? I got 10 of them at this random gas station because I couldn't find them anywhere. Yeah. Anyway.
It all worked out for you. They're all gone now.
They're all gone. So it was March, basically, around that time. And right away, the hospital took it really seriously and pulled you. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're in that. I think that was a high level of stress. And then the other thing that happened was the kids stopped going to school. Mm-hmm, I mean, everybody knows all this.
Yeah.
So the kids stopped going to school, and then every meeting that we're doing is a Zoom meeting, and then we're not supposed to like be with anybody, right? So we're all supposed to be isolating. Yep. So you and I like have done the podcast like in person at my house.
Yeah.
And so this was like kind of killed it. We're like, okay, well, we'll just wait till this blows over, and it never did. And in the meantime, over the in fall, I moved.
So you moved. We were living, we were basically neighbors about 10 minutes away, tops, in Milwaukee. And then you moved where?
I moved to Kansas City, Missouri, where it's going to be in the 50s today. What's your temp?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's been nice lately. It's been in the 40s the last couple of days, but it has been really cold and rugged for the last couple of weeks. So I think it's consistently you're in better shape weather-wise than the old Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Until summertime.
Until summer, then it's blazing hot.
It's just kind of a buggy swampscape.
In the summer? Okay.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, it's all right. You need lots of swimming pools and, like, you know, otter pops, and things work out for you.
Right.
But anyway. Well,
what I remember about, like, that transition period was that, like, I remember hearing little, like, rumblings about COVID, and it was all, you know, it seemed something that was, like, really far away. It was happening in China. It's like one of those stories that you read and you're like, that really sucks for them. Like, they're on quarantine. Like, yikes, that would be awful. And then you like move on with your day, you know, which is like typical American narcissism. It's like, it doesn't bother me until it's like at my doorstep.
Girl, they're suffering over there.
It's like, that sucks. On to the next podcast.
Bummer.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I know. It's bad.
I'm gonna get
anyway,
a burger.
I know. But then, like, I remember listening to an episode of The Daily. You ever listen to The Daily with Michael Barbaro? It's a New York Times podcast.
No, because I'm not intelligent enough.
It's pretty good. Anyway, they like take one story and they do a really deep dive into it. And so on The Daily, they had this medical expert on to talk about COVID. And this guy just meticulously laid out step by step why this was a big deal, why this was coming to all of us and going to affect our lives for the next however many years. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. Like, no one was talking about that at that point. And I was like, and when it's in New York Times, you kind of take it seriously. And
so did it touch on the fine line between preparedness and paranoia for you?
I mean, I was starting to feel a little paranoid, I'll be honest.
And maybe rightfully so.
Yeah. I went to my small group and I told them about it, and they were like, no. It's all hype. It's hysteria. It's just a cold or whatever. You'll be fine. And they have apologized since then, said I was right. So, you know, it's all good. No hard feelings. So I remember feeling like I was on the inside of this thing's coming when no one else was really caring at that point. And then there was that weekend when, you remember the weekend? So it was like a Friday or something. And my boss, I remember, coming to me was like, hey, you know, you've probably heard about COVID. You might want to like test your at-home equipment. We might be like at home for a couple of weeks or something, whatever. And then that weekend, it was the weekend that Tom Hanks got it and the basketball started shutting down and stuff. And it's like, it's so funny that it took Tom Hanks getting it for everyone to be like, oh my God. And like, this is serious.
Well, they're like, that guy saved Private Ryan.
Exactly.
That's Forrest Gump got it. That's like, he survived everything.
Yeah. He's going to be our national barometer from now on. It's like some crisis is going to happen. It's like, well, how's Tom Hanks doing? It's like, I'm not worrying until.
And he's that figure that can bridge the divide politically.
He is. Know? He's that everyman. It doesn't matter what you believe. Tom Hanks is in your corner. That's right. So there you go. That was the transition. And then basically from that, after that weekend, that Monday, we started working from home and we've been working at home for 2 years. So that, it was crazy. It happened so fast.
You've been working? No, I'm joking.
Yeah. I know. You're so lucky because you're in a little hiatus,
partially,
right?
Retired.
No, I was for a while, but basically they kept shutting the schools down off and on. And I have 3 kids, and so it became this thing where I was like, well, forget this. And then now I may go do some more chaplaincy stuff. I'm not sure, but...
Good. I mean, you should, because you're really good at it. And I always tell Tim this, and I mean this with all my heart. If I was dying, I would want Tim to be the one that walked into my hospital room. He just has a beautiful spirit, and he would instantly put me at ease. So you should do
that. Are you obligating me to this?
I'm telling you.
In the event of my death, you must swear... Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, man. I appreciate that. Yeah,
absolutely. So, well, that's good. So we've touched on it a little bit. In the last 2 years, after that big transition, you moved. You're taking a little break right now. You might get back into the chaplaincy. We talked about school, how terrible that was, the Chromebooks and all that. Did your kids have Chromebooks? Oh, geez. Just the worst.
Yeah. And like you, like, I'm like, oh, my kid is, I had this moment and I'm just going to let him. The world's going to know.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, he's so diligent in his studies. I don't know if he had any of these moments. And then I realized he was just instant messaging and playing some kind of video
playing
game.
Playing Minecraft.
Right. Yeah. And I thought he was studying for like 16 hours a day. I was like, what? Right. I believed what I wanted to believe, John.
100%. Our oldest totally took advantage of that, was on a separate screen the whole time. The teachers had multiple conferences with us. And finally, my wife just pulled him and was like, I can't do this anymore. You're not on a screen. You're going to be homeschooled. And that was a separate disaster. I won't get into it. But anyway, it was bad. Bad times for all parents. Yes.
I think it's rough. It was a rough transition because I don't think we were used to like all being in one spot all the time.
Right. And I had like, so basically that year, 2020, was the busiest year at my company ever, because for whatever reason, people were buying houses left and right. And so you had this terrible situation. I'm working from home, and for whatever reason, I picked my dark son's bedroom. There's no natural light. It's just like oppressively dark in there. And
I thought
I'm
you were going to say your dark son. I'm like, which one's the dark one?
Well, he is dark. There's that. But no, Reading. It was like no natural light. And I'm sitting on a dining room table chair like all day. And my back is starting to kill me. And I remember like there was this one night where like I'm so busy. It's like 11:30 at night. There's so much still to do. It's dark. My back is hurting. And I like started crying. Like I had basically a nervous breakdown. Like I just couldn't do it anymore. So my wife, she was finally like, no, here's what you're going to do. You're going into our bedroom. And I was like, no, I have to move all my equipment and stuff. She's like, no, you're doing this and you're trying it out for a week. And thank God she saved it, because I went into this new space. There's light just pouring in from all these windows. I got my office chair. I just went to the office and just threw it in the back of my car. And from that point on, it was like night and day for me.
It makes a big difference, because then you have distinct places that you are.
Yeah.
I know for like when I was doing like chaplaincy from home, which is just like the most relational thing done in the least relational way.
Oh, yeah.
I just remember like that I felt so good to go, even when we didn't know like, okay, what's going to happen with COVID. And they were like, okay, you guys can come back to the office and there's no, but you can't be in the same office and all that. It felt so good to be back at an office with a window and just to feel like I had my workspace was separate from my home space. Because I know you're still not there, right?
I'm not there. And I will say that's the one thing that I consider a bit of a blessing about COVID, which I hate saying because I know it's, you know, all the caveats that so much suffering has happened because of it, and a lot of people, it's not been a blessing. But
you're talking for you.
For me, it has been, because I was in a rhythm before COVID where I was basically working 8 to 6 at the office, and then you throw in 20-minute commutes each way. I never saw my family Monday through Friday. It was just like, I never did. And I couldn't, I don't think I would have expressed it at the time, but like being home, I realized how much I didn't see them, how disconnected I was from them. And so being able to just hear them in the background, to walk out into the living room and there they are, like, has been a really big blessing for me. Yeah, I will say that.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad that happened for you.
Yeah.
It does kind of have led to a lot of people to reexamine their how they live, how they love their, you know, the people around them, all those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think there's any going back on the work front. Once people have tasted that, we're not going back to 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. I think we'll get back to a couple days a week or something. And I do appreciate going back into the office. It is nice, like you said, being kind of getting away from it every once in a while. But I do like the rhythm, the hybrid environment. So yeah.
So anyway, you guys, I know you tune in to hear about our lives.
No. Well, and we'd like to hear from our listeners too. I mean, if you guys want to drop us a line about what your transition was like, what the last 2 years have been like for you, please do. You can comment on the page, on the site, on Facebook. You can even email us at podcast@cinemafaith.com, and we'd like to read some of your perspectives over the last couple of years, if you would let us. Yeah.
So here's something I was wondering about. I think that for all the listeners, our relationship with movies has changed in 2 years. I used to look at a movie as an event that I would prepare for. I would go to a theater and that would be the movie experience. In fact, many times we were like, well, if you don't see it in the theater, you didn't really see the same movie.
Yep.
And I think that our relationship with movies has completely changed since our last podcast, to the point where like we default to, all right, what's the latest movie? And we just really lean heavy into the devices now that we've been trapped for 2 years, right?
Well, yeah, it was the combination of being trapped for 2 years and the combination of streaming services just totally taking over, basically. You know, when you've got the new Matrix being just streamed to HBO, it's like, it's a totally different environment now. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of changed everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I don't know if it's further democratized the industry. I mean, that's not like kind of we're talking about specific movies. I kind of have that feeling where like we used to be in anticipation of the next release. And now I'm kind of like, You know, I don't have that same feel anymore. I'm like, okay, we'll see. And then you don't, it used to be that the movie theater was the place that kind of culled the junk out. So like if it was terrible and not marketable, usually it wouldn't ever be in a theater. But now it's like, I don't know the difference between, you know, a kid movie, I don't know, Toy Story 9 and some Academy Award winning movie. I have no idea the difference anymore.
Right. Because every other minute, there's a new movie just popping up on Netflix with The Rock. And you're like, you know, Dan Baker, by the way, hated that movie. I forget what it was called. But whatever movie that was with The Rock that has red in the title, he hated it. And shout out to Dan, who I'm sure is listening right now.
Is it some kind of revenge narrative?
Something like that.
I don't think Dan likes those revenge narratives.
Yes.
We're going to set everything right by murder. Mass murder.
Red Notice. I looked it up. Sorry. Red Notice is what that's called on Netflix, and he was not a fan. But no, I know what you're saying. It's like with streaming, it's just a totally different atmosphere. It's like, whereas in the old days, it was like you have this release schedule. These three movies are coming out. One of them's usually really worth seeing or whatever. And now it's just movies are popping up everywhere. And that's combined, of course, with TV shows on the same platform. And so it's all just kind of melding together in this big mushy stew. And I think, you know, reviews matter more than ever because
that's so true, man. That is so true. It's like we have to, like, I feel in the last couple of years, we have to like if you didn't have a reviewer that you trusted, then you were just basically, you're going to be watching whatever the algorithm tells you.
No, of course.
And I'm doing that a lot already, but like, it's like, oh, so some low production cost garbage.
Yep.
Versus good low production cost stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's, I think it was tough out there to be a fan of movies because it isn't a prioritizing of quality anymore. It just all comes into the same thing.
And a lot of people are predicting that, like I was reading an interview with Ben Affleck the other day, and he was predicting that basically the future is movie theaters are just going to be reserved for the event films. You're basically going to have a new Marvel movie every now and then everything else is just going to go straight to Netflix, Hulu, whatever. And I don't know. Part of me is like, I like it in the sense that, like, you know, when I have to prepare for the Oscars or something, I just have access to all the films. Whereas before I had to like go out to the theater 20 times in November and December and see all the Oscar movies, it would be nice for them to all just be available. But at the same time, if you lose that theater experience, you know, that not just a Marvel movie, but like just going to see a really good art house movie with other people, that is important. And I'm really sad that that's kind of fizzling out.
Yeah, I am too. I also think like it's not so much the movie or the format, it's also our attention span. So like if you watch anything at home and you miss part of the dialogue, you can rewind. No problem.
Yep. Or hey Siri, go back 20 seconds.
If you want to like, all right, I'm going to bake a cake and watch a movie, which I like, this just happens. We're here. We're living in our homes with a bunch of kids, right? You can like give a movie part of your attention and then you'll go, well, if I want to watch it, I'll just go back and I'll really pay attention to it. But in a theater, like you paid $10 or more, you bought popcorn that was $10 or more. And if you miss a part of it, that's it. Like you've lost it. So it's almost like the current format allows you to not value the experience, the actual, when you're in the experience as much as you would.
That's a really good point. It's like in the theater, I get terrified if I start to have to think I have to go to the bathroom or something. It's like, I don't want to miss anything. But at home, you're just like, ugh, you know, you pause it, you go, and then maybe you never come back.
Right. And then the pacing is like, so it's some crescendo of action that's going to lead to some revelation about the character. And you're like, I'm going to go pee now. Push pause.
Right. Instead of waiting for the right moment, you just pause it at like the climax and you're
like, I'll be right back, movie. Right. You don't have to like be subject to the pacing of the director, which I think really kind of kills it, because that's one of the things about the movie is the director controls time. And now with everything streaming, it's we control the time. And so it makes us a little bit more able to watch these things whimsically rather than to give our full attention.
Right. And that makes a lot more sense of why Christopher Nolan is so upset about like Warner Brothers streaming directly to HBO and stuff. Cause at first you're just like, chill out, dude. Like, you know, but that's his point, is that he wants to be in control of the time. He wants to be in control of the story that's being told instead of you having a remote in your hand or God forbid your phone, just whipping that out when you get that text and you've missed two scenes. It's honestly, it's not great from a filmmaker standpoint when you're trying to lead someone on a journey. But at least there are still movies to talk about, and we are here to talk about one today. So I can't believe this is our first time back. I mean, the site, so we were talking about our personal lives. The site has been basically dormant for 2 years, cinemafaith.com. That's what it's called, if anyone's forgotten, cinemafaith.com. We have like had, I think, 3 or 4 new reviews in the last 2 years. Just randomly someone was like, hey, I wrote something. I'm like, great. But it just, because what happened is in 2020, the theaters completely went dead for at least a year. There was nothing coming out. All the production was halted. So there was nothing to see. And I was just like, well, and then with all the stuff going on in everyone's personal life, I wasn't like, hey, just keep sending me a bunch of movie reviews. It seemed really trite. So I just made the decision, like, let's just pull the plug on everything for a while. And that turned into this 2 year hiatus. So we're kind of in the warm up phase where we're getting back into the podcast. We're going to maybe write some new stuff on the website. So I'm not like, you know, cue the confetti. We're back. We're just trying it out with the
a
hope.
Soft, a soft, like, yeah. We're just trying it out. Saying, hey, is anybody here interested in movies anymore?
Right.
I hope
right.
so. I think they are. I think so.
I think it's the right time. So that's kind of where we're at. And so here we go. We're going to talk about movies again. And we are ready today. We have watched a movie and we're here to talk about it. And that movie, Tim, is The Power of the Dog. So here we go. Let's do it. Let's talk about it. Now, the reason I picked The Power of the Dog for our first show back was kind of twofold. One, it was on Netflix, going back to what we're talking about. It was easy to watch. Now, you live, because you mentioned to me that you live in Kansas City, which is kind of, it's a little bit harder to find indie movies, right? You have to drive
on
a little bit.
On the north side of Kansas City, it's a lot harder. I mean, on the south side, it's like, I guess they're more cultured over there, but anyway.
Yeah, it's a bit of a trek for you. Yeah, so it's nice when it's convenient. You can just press play at home, right?
So all the things I slandered the movies against just now, I was like, John, you must make it easy for me, and I must be able to push pause
must watch
and
it at home. You're a hypocrite. Perfect.
I am. What can I say?
Yeah, so that was the first reason I picked it. And then secondly, I picked it because it's widely regarded as the best film of last year. And the Oscar nominations were just announced a few days ago. And it leading the pack is The Power of the Dog with 12 nominations in all major categories. I know. So I thought if we're going to return to things here, we might as well pick the quote-unquote best movie of last year and see what it's all about. So that's why I picked it. And that's why we're talking about it today. So here we go. Now, Tim, when did you actually watch this movie?
Probably probably after we had talked, I watched it a week later, and then I watched it this week again.
Good. Okay. So you're caught up. You're ready.
Yeah, here we go.
Good. And how would you describe this film to someone who has no idea what we're talking about, who's never seen it before or heard about it before?
So I can give you like what's the vibe of it. You remember that film? It was P.T. Anderson with Daniel Day-Lewis.
And, There Will Be Blood.
It had a vibe like There Will Be Blood. Yes, and I don't know if it's the music.
It's the music.
Yeah. So it has like and it's definitely a movie that is a psychological thriller. It's suspense. So like you're always uncomfortable. It's 2 hours of being uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You're never quite sure. It always has this feeling like something bad's going to happen, which makes it difficult to watch. But it felt like There Will Be Blood, where it's like always these awkward things. Great acting, and you feel like someone's gonna die all the time.
All the time.
Just a lot of suspense, and it makes you want to know what the characters are thinking, which I think good psychological, you know, drama stuff does that, where you're like, what's going on? Who is this person crazy, or is this person crazy? What's going on? It had a mystery to it, so you want to know like what's really happening, because the filmmaker / author only gives us some like little breadcrumbs when we have to try to figure it out.
Kind of unravels over the course of the
2 hours. Unravels. Yeah.
As far as like the minutia of the plot, I mean, it's a little difficult to describe, but you got these two brothers. Phil is one of them, is played by Benedict Cumberbatch. And love that name. Just drips off the tongue. Benedict Cumberbatch.
Is that a real name?
It has to be. I mean, you wouldn't make up something like that. You can't. And so,
he's sound real.
I know. So those are the two. So Phil is played by Benedict Cumberbatch, and then George is played by Jesse Plemons, and they're like these two ranchers, and they live on this ranch, and they herd whatever ranchers do, herd animals or something, and they couldn't be more different from each other, right? Because Phil is like this really ultimate cowboy dude. He's like a macho man. He's really callous. He's rough. lashes out at people, got some anger issues.
He's kind of mean.
Mean, right? He calls his brother Fatso, which is not a term of endearment, I wouldn't think. He's right. He's got this mean streak. And then George is very soft-spoken, like humble, quiet, you know, kind of just has this kindness that you can tell about him. So they're like polar opposites, these brothers. Yeah. And then along the way, they meet this woman named Rose, who is played by Kirsten Dunst, and she has a teenage son named Peter, who's played by Cody Smith McPhee. And then so they meet, and then George kind of takes to them, and they end up George gets married to Rose, and that's where the conflict starts, because then they end up moving into the ranch with Phil, and Phil is not excited about this because Phil thinks that Rose is taking advantage of George, and from there you kind of have this escalating series of events. So that's kind of the basic plot that gets you to the heart of the movie in about 30 minutes. So yeah. And it's written and directed by Jane Campion. Tim, were you familiar at all with her work before watching this?
Piano, I think.
The
right?
Piano. That's her most famous movie. I know. Did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it, but a long time ago. But yeah,
I hadn't seen it, but I watched it to prepare for this podcast because that's just the kind of researcher I am. But yeah, I watched The Piano, and that's when I realized kind of the essence of her work. I realized like a couple of things. One, that she makes kind of quirky, off the beaten path movies. Like, they're not, none of her movies are things that you can describe easily in like one sentence, right? They're very like obscure, sort of. No one else makes movies like her in the same way, you could say that about Tarantino, right? Like the true auteurs, right? They just sort of make their march to their own beat. That was the first thing. And two, she is very interested in human sexuality. Like, that seems to be a common theme that comes up in her work in The Piano. In this one, you know, there's another movie called In the Cut that I didn't see, but it's one of hers with Meg Ryan. That's widely known as the movie where Meg Ryan gets naked. It's like a psychological sexual thriller or something.
Well, thank you for letting all these 14-year-old boys be aware of that now. You and all the internet. Thank you.
Yeah. No, yeah. But like, so all I say, all that to say is that like, she's
they don't
clearly
know who Meg Ryan is, so I think we're okay. Yeah.
I think a lot of people don't know who Meg Ryan is, unfortunately. Yes.
She's a Kiwi, right? She's from New Zealand.
That is something I did not research, which I should have. That's shame on me.
I think she is.
I'm sure she is.
I'll do it quickly. You know,
Sam Neill is a Kiwi, he was in The Piano. There you go. There you go.
I think it took place in. Didn't it take place in New Zealand?
The Piano, I don't know where it took place, but it's such a weird movie. That movie is like, it's Holly Hunter plays this like mute woman, and she's obsessed with playing this one piano, and Harvey Keitel is like, okay. So just briefly, just to give you the listeners a flavor of like, these are the kind of movies she makes. So like, you got this mute woman, she's somehow betrothed to Sam Neill, who's like a Kiwi, and he lives on this random island, and she moves there to this island with their piano, and then Harvey Keitel is like involved in this native tribe that lives on the island, and he's like, I want piano lessons. And so she's like, okay. And then she starts doing piano lessons at his house, but he doesn't actually want to learn the piano because he makes this deal with her, like, for every, you come over here, for every key on the black key on the piano, you give me a lesson, but during the lessons you play, and I'm just gonna sort of like take my clothes off and like do weird things. And so they just end up doing this like sexual thing instead of piano lessons.
Sounds like Louis C.K.
No.
So horrible.
Too soon. I know.
Okay. It's been a while, but yeah.
So that's
what
happens. And so then they start, but then, so she like hates that at first, but then they eventually fall in love, and Sam Neill is like very upset because obviously, and he starts getting really mad, and that's the movie. It's a weird movie. It's good. I will say it's really a really good one, but you know, it's nice having a movie that you can easily like, you know, have a tagline for, right? You know, like four Jamaicans. Go
are
to Canada
about the bobsled?
To complete in the bobsled competition. Yeah, you say that, and people are like, I get it. I know exactly
Jamaica
what that movie is all
got
about.
A bobsled team, the only hey, one there is. Yeah,
Jamaica. You know, we can't believe. Love
right,
that movie.
We're offending somebody, right?
I'm sorry
I just know
about
we
the
are.
Accent.
It's
I
your
shouldn't
fault.
Have done that.
I'm gonna.
That was my fault.
No. It was. I think the film itself was the problem, not you, John.
Well, I have a special place in my heart for that movie, and I did have to mention it because it's the Olympics, and I've been obsessively watching the Olympics all week. Love it. But the point is that that's an easy movie to describe, but none of her movies are easy to describe, but that's not a bad thing, and I like that she's doing her thing.
And she tends to adapt, from what I've seen, will take a short story or a novel and then adapt that to a film. Which
and this I, was an I think, adapted screenplay, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that's part of it, is that there's a complexity in the novel or in the film that will give you, and she has to create place, right? So where an author would describe it, she has to show it. So anyway, kind of neat.
What did you think about specifically her writing and directing in this movie? Was there anything that stood out to you about those two elements?
From what I understand is that the screenplay is very faithful to the book.
Okay.
And as far as her directing, I think one of the things I like about it is the land becomes a character.
Yes.
At least that's my, I don't know. I've read like no reviews on this movie, so I'm coming in real cold, but it does seem like the land is a character and that we have to like always be appreciating the land and the setting and the place. It's very important. And so I like it. It's very sparse. Like the narrative is sparse. So people talk in like just kind of phrases.
Yeah. Even the dialogue is very deliberate and very sparse, right?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of monologues. It's a very punchy dialogue. Yeah.
And it seems like there's like all the extra type characters don't get any dialogue hardly at all.
Right. Right.
So really focusing on these one-on-one interactions. So it really is like a series of two people.
Yep.
Just different people having these interactions rather than like a group of people or it's a whole bunch of people having weird, awkward interactions.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt the same way. And her writing, like there was a lot of lines that really stood out to me. And I don't know if those, she's just pulling them directly from the book or if they were original lines of hers. But I mean, there were lines that I like wrote down because they were just really powerful to me. But yeah, so the writing is really powerful. And then I agree with you about the directing too. It's just like these sweeping shots of the countryside and the way that becomes a secondary character. It's beautiful.
And I know the author, he wrote from experience. So like he was forced, his mom got remarried and he had to go work the ranch.
Mm.
And he ended up, you know, becoming an author and going to university and everything. But he had to go back and work the ranch. He never felt like he ever fit in. And so I think that was a big deal. And then later on in his life, you know, he became an author and got married and everything. And then later in his life, he reveals, well, I'm homosexual. And so, and I think in some interviews, he's like, no, I'm not bisexual. I'm homosexual. And so it was like a big, you know, I don't know what that would have been back then. That might have been pretty controversial. But in any case, it's like it has all this stuff is rooted in the author's experience. So I think she read the book from what I understand and was like, she couldn't stop thinking about it.
And all of that shows up.
Yeah. All of it shows up. And I think that you can tell when somebody's working off of something that is a deep knowledge of the actual things like cattle ranching and because
there's an authenticity to it. Yeah,
there is. And like, I would have thought, oh, ropes are probably made out of like fibers. Oh no, they're made out of rawhide. And I
which I did not
that.
Know either.
No
yeah.
idea. No idea. Yeah. And that's probably basic cowboy knowledge, but I just don't know that.
Right.
Or what it's like to actually work a ranch. You get some of that authenticity. So I think that was kind of neat.
And we got to talk about the music. You already mentioned it, but it's an integral part of the movie. Like just like the countryside, the music totally becomes another character. So the music is, of course, composed by Johnny Greenwood of which band, Tim?
Oh, is it Radiohead?
Radiohead, no. Of course.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah, okay. Of course.
All right.
Dude, Radiohead is one of my favorite bands of all time, man. I remember getting to them in college. It's like I had never heard music before, man. Popping on Kid A, OK Computer, they changed my life when it came to music. I went down that rabbit hole hard. They're still one of my favorite bands. Johnny Greenwood is the main guitarist of Radiohead, and he has really gotten in to composing films. He actually had three movies that he composed in 2021 alone. Three. So there's this one.
I had no idea.
There's this one, and there is Spencer, which was that Kristen Stewart Princess Diana movie. And then he did Licorice Pizza, Paul Thomas Anderson's new movie. I really want to see that. It looks so good. But so that was three movies he did in 2021 alone. His most famous movie that the one that stood out to me the most is what you already mentioned is There Will Be Blood. That was the first time that I like heard a score that I was like, wow, like who did that? And then I realized it was Johnny Greenwood. And like, because.
So I just nailed that like just off the top of my head. Wow.
Yeah,
that's
totally.
Pretty good, man. I'm impressed. myself. That's good. You did the research, and I was like, it felt like this other score.
But they're very similar because both of them have this very eerie vibe that's like something's going to happen. This is all leading to something bad, right? Like that's like the vibe of the movie. And if you think about like in The Power of the Dog, you could have inserted some like Western orchestral, you know, like it could have been a totally felt like a totally different movie. But instead, you've got this Johnny Greenwood score, which just gives it this very off-kilter, eerie, kind of like strange vibe from beginning to end. And it's this sense of foreboding, and it's the same way with There Will Be Blood, where it's like all I remember in There Will Be Blood, it's like all these shots of Daniel Day-Lewis covered in oil with like clanking sounds and, you know, just crazy. Yeah, he's really thoughtful in how he approaches every movie.
So it's kind of like dissonant with like kind of a lot of strings and kind of staccato a little bit in some sections. So you're used to like the Hitchcock, you know, like that kind of like staccato string section, but this is a little different. It's like lower. Yeah, but it makes it's like unnerving. It's interesting how I'd love to, well, I wouldn't love to, but you could watch it without the music and see what this, see if this film had the same power. I very much doubt it.
Totally.
Because the music never, I never feel good when that music is on. It's not my, you know, drive by the beach with a convertible music.
Right. That's what I'm saying. You have like a random shot of like, you know, someone walking upstairs to that music, and it just totally is a different vibe. It's like, oh no, it's someone's about to die. That's like you said. I think that's what you said. That's how I felt about every second of this movie and There Will Be Blood. Yeah.
Like who's bad? Who's good? Who's going to die?
Yeah.
How's this going to end? What's the,
I know.
It just takes energy to watch. Yeah.
And I should mention that Greenwood was nominated for an Oscar for this movie for his score. That was just announced a few days ago. So, and he's been nominated twice. So he actually wasn't nominated for There Will Be Blood, which is a crime. He should have been. But he was nominated for Phantom Thread, another Paul Thomas Anderson movie, and he's nominated for this one. So he has two now. So like everyone else connected with this movie, he was nominated. So there you go, Johnny Greenwood. Well done. All right. Let's talk about our man, Benny Cumberbatch, as I like to call him. So, Benedict Cumberbatch, a very prestigious actor, obviously, is known for lots of things. The BBC TV show Sherlock, The Imitation Game, I think was his big Oscar moment.
That's a good movie.
Yep, that was a good movie. He's done some fun roles lately. He was the villain in one of the Star Trek movies, and he's Doctor Strange now in the Marvel movies. So, you know, he can let his hair down too.
I was watching it, and my kid like walked into the room, and he's like, "Dad, that's Doctor Strange." I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "Oh yeah, it is."
Yeah, that's true. So he can play both sides of the fence. He can be very prestigious, and he can also have fun. But he's one of those just like classically trained, you know, British actor dudes who's just never gonna make a false step. He's always gonna bring it. You just know. Yeah. And so, what do you think about Cumberbatch in this movie, Tim? And kind of unpack Phil for us and Cumberbatch's approach to the character.
So Phil is interesting because we get little details about him revealed throughout the film, but he has an elaborate persona that he's created, and he has created this persona that is the Western cowboy rancher, stoic, emotionally removed kind of persona that attacks weakness and admires strength and seeks to be the strongest thing around as far as people. And then we see slowly, we see that begins to get chipped away. We get revealed like who that he might be that, but a lot of he's Ivy League educated.
Yeah.
He went to Yale. Like he is like incredibly intelligent dude. He major in classics is what they said. So he knows Greek and Latin, and he's like super well educated. So he's fronting this rancher, persona, and he's good at it. Like he's good at ranching, but he's fronting this thing to get a reaction from the people around him. He's doing that.
And Campion's very deliberate in how she reveals the character to us, right? Because at first, he's just a two-dimensional monster. He's just a terrible person who's dirty and awful and treats everyone like garbage. And then over the course of the movie, suddenly we see all these different sides that we didn't see before, right? Like, he's got this father figure who means a lot to him named Bronco Henry, who kind of taught him how to be a rancher. And we see that there is, it's not just that he admires him for what he taught him. There is a sexual component to that. We see, as the sort of omniscient viewer, we see him go to this secret place in the woods, and we see, you know, kind of that side to him, that he, there's a, some clothing from Bronco Henry, and he kind of drapes it over himself in a sensual way. And we see that there's more going on there. And yet this is a person who openly berated Peter for what he perceived as, you know, kind of being more effeminate. And so there's just a lot of layers that are revealed to us very slowly, and it's really fascinating.
Yeah, so that character is like super, I feel very, this is very enigmatic, like, as far as like who was this person, and then the fact that his brother was there the whole time, and his brother doesn't seem to have any reverence for Bronco Henry at all.
That's such a good point. Yeah.
So I left me wondering, like, what was the difference in there? Because he basically has turned Bronco Henry into a saint. Like,
absolutely.
He has an altar to him, who is this character who taught him the basically, you know, obviously rope, ride, ranch, and then also taught him about his sexuality.
Yeah.
That's what we get. We don't get the full story, though. We don't know exactly how that happened. We get some of it. And now he's like eternally reverenced, and he's having the whole ranch has to like kind of revolve around this dead person, which is really, and it's very interesting. And that happens in systems, right? Family systems too. So that there might be somebody that's no longer living, but everybody else is living according to how to that person. Mm-hmm. So it seems like that's what's going on the ranch.
And when he gets frustrated, he goes and polishes Bronco Henry's saddle, you know, and it's this, mm-hmm. it's this worshipful ritual. And you're right. I wonder, we just don't know, but I wonder why what George's opinion or relation to Bronco Henry is, because there, you know, there's that scene where Phil brings up, you know, what we should do is we should go out to the middle of the countryside and, you know, roast up some game just like Bronco Henry taught us. And George is just dead faced, you know, and it's like,
or like drinking to Bronco Henry. He's like, oh no, thanks.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to drink to him. He doesn't care that they went out. And it makes me go like, well, does he know, like, is there something that character knows that we don't know about Bronco Henry that makes him like not have reverence for him? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, like, but it seems like he's kind of trying to create the cult of Bronco Henry amongst the men, right? Like the hired hands and everything, but his brother's not really buying into it.
Right.
For whatever reason. And so it makes it mysterious. You're like, whoa, I wonder what's going on here.
Yeah. Cumberbatch is great, though. I mean, he really, like, that's a character we've never seen him play before, you know, in anything even remotely like that. Yeah, he just plays that, all those layers, very rough around the edges, but also this tenderness that emerges, and I think he really knocks it out of the park. So it's a great performance, and I think I would not be shocked if he wins Best Actor for that. It's really good.
Yeah, I thought he did well. It's kind of neat because he's English. He gets the accent kind of, I mean, pretty close, right?
Ballpark, yeah.
Yeah, ballpark. And then because he's pretending to be this, he is a rancher, but he's also pretending to be a rancher in some ways.
Right. It's a persona,
like
with
his colloquialisms, and like, he's done a good job. But I think it doesn't really matter in this role that he's English, because he's, you know, he's supposed to be somebody who has a front. And so even if he's fronting an American accent, Western, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. And this is also the best that I've seen from Jesse Plemons, who plays George, the other brother. Are you familiar with his work at all? He's
in
Breaking Bad. Yeah, he's in Breaking Bad. That maybe that's what most people know him for. I remember most recently Fargo. I love that show, and he was in a season of that with Kirsten Dunst, who, by the way, they are in a real life relationship, or at least they were at some point.
He's an interesting actor because he could play different. He can play different characters like that are like would be opposed to each other. So he could play, like, for a while, I think when he first was on Breaking Bad, they called him Baby Matt Damon.
Nice.
Or something like that. So like the idea was like he had a level of like where he was kind of a tough guy, even though he had a baby face. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then he can also play like a character that's like being like verbally abused in this one. And
right. And you feel for
and
him.
And he could play a gangster too. So you're like, what? I think it's like his look gives him some range. He kind of played this like wet noodle of a person who was non-reactive. That's how I would describe him.
Yes. He can be yelled at by Phil, and he's just able to maintain neutrality somehow.
There was some kind of strength in that.
Mm-hmm. Cause it's not, you're right. I'm terrible. It's not being a doormat, but there is like a very quiet strength about him.
Which makes you wonder, like, why is he putting up with this? Like, maybe he knows something that we don't know. Because he didn't seem like he had to put up with it. He just kind of let it be. Like, he's just like, okay, this guy. He treated it like he was acting out. He kind of treated him like a child, actually. He seemed like he was afraid of his reaction, But he also like treated him a little bit like a child, which I think was weird.
You wonder if it's possible that Bronco Henry maybe took advantage of Phil in some way, and that's why there's a lot of grace being given, you know, because maybe he saw a change after that happened. I don't know. That's pure speculation, but it's, you know, it's kind of filling in the gaps of the story, which is interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's like, who knows? Like, yeah, we're just like kind of like using, we got this negative space to work with, and we can't really, well, it's not even that because we don't know what it is. So it's just mystery. So we don't know what happened. And so we could fill it in with stuff, but we just don't know.
Yeah.
And so we're supposed to, like, based on the characters, try to piece together something. And sometimes we do well and sometimes we don't. It's like looking at the hill, right? What do you see?
My favorite scene with Jesse Plemons in this one is when he's with Rose, Kristen Dunst, and they're on the countryside, you know, they stop at that like vista and stuff. And then she wants to teach him to dance and he starts crying and she's like, why are you crying? And he says this line. He says, it's just nice. How nice it is to not be alone is I think how he says it. And I just thought that was really beautiful. It's a beautiful scene. And it reminds me of just that beauty of a new relationship. Like I've been married for 16 years, but I still remember to this day when I met my wife in college. And there is that point where it's sort of, you're on your own path, you're carrying your own burdens. And then suddenly you're with someone and it's a future and it's we, and we have plans and we, you know, it was a really tender, beautiful scene. I liked it.
What is it, George?
I want to say how nice it is not to be alone.
And so what's interesting is like the contrast, right? Because his brother wants him to like be like, oh, this is Bronco Henry Day and we did this and we did that and we did this. And remember when we did that? Mm-hmm. And his brother rejects that, like, so he's not alone. Like, he lives with his brother, right?
Yeah, that's true.
But he rejects, like, that as a real relationship. Yeah, that scene, like, it was like, oh, yeah, it is. It's kind of touching, but it's also, is he in love with this woman? Or is he just, it makes him feel not alone anymore? Or she's, like, a solution for his loneliness? I don't know.
Because he's not really there for her as things progress throughout the movie, you know? And when she starts going through some hard times, I mean, he is and he isn't, right? I don't know.
They don't seem to have a level of intimacy until maybe the end they do.
But he's great in it. Oscar nominated for this, of course, like everyone else. And yeah, so congratulations. That is his first Oscar nominations, Jesse Plemons. So there you go.
Nice work.
I know. And then the last two main actors would be Kristen Dunst, Rose, and Peter, the teenage boy. He's played by Cody Smith McPhee. Do you have anything to say about their performances?
I thought the performances are all excellent.
You really feel for Rose, right? With all the cruelty that Phil pours on her with that dang piano playing. That was hard to watch, right? Because like there's like this dinner party, Rose plays the piano and she is trying to like practice to like impress these dignitaries that are coming over. And so there's this amazing scene where Rose is practicing the piano, right? And Phil plays the banjo, right? And he is upstairs and he's sort of mockingly playing with her. Every time she like starts playing, he'll like play on the banjo, and then he sort of uses that as a taunt throughout the rest of the movie. He'll just whistle that tune to kind of get in her head.
Right?
Yeah. And there's that devastating scene where she, you know, chickens out about playing the piano, and he comes in and she's all obviously like really torn up that she couldn't muster up the courage to play. And all he does, he doesn't like, you know, lay into her. All he does is just start whistling that tune and then walks away. It's awful. So you feel for her in that way, and she plays that vulnerability really well. And yeah, the kid, Smith McPhee, does a good job. Also nominated for an Oscar.
I think what's interesting to watch throughout the movie is there's times when his level of, like, where he's so deliberate and in control. And so I think maybe that's the whole time. So he's, like, deliberate and he's in control. He will do, like, make flowers and dissect animals because he wants to be a doctor or whatever. And like his dad was. And so he'll do all these things and he's very deliberate and methodical and he's in a high degree of competence. it's like he walks in onto the ranch. And it's not that way. It's like
totally out of his element. Yeah.
Yeah. But he makes choices. Like, you remember the shoes?
No.
So he chooses white tennis shoes to wear on the ranch, even though he owns boots, and he does it on purpose.
Interesting.
Because he's trying to cultivate an image, which is really interesting. Yeah. So I liked, which is a writing thing. That's not the actor himself, but I think that he really walked an interesting line.
Well, we mentioned the quiet strength of George, and I feel like he also has a quiet strength, right? Like, he knows he's out of his element, but he doesn't just give up and run away. Like, he sticks with it, he perseveres, and he stands up for himself. Like, I think he has a high degree of self-image and self-confidence in the face of, you know, dealing with kind of feeling maybe like an alien in this world.
I'm never quite sure if he is vulnerable or if he is calculated.
Yeah, right.
So
he straddles that line. He does.
There's some of that's the writing, but most of that's the acting.
So well deserves of Oscar noms all around from that main cast. There you go. All right, Tim, as we try to kind of bring this one to a close, what are some themes that stood out to you in The Power of the Dog? Is there some truth that spoke to you as you watched it?
So I think one of the things, well, first, you know, we know that the title is from Psalm 22.
Well, yeah, let me read that. So
yeah, go ahead. This,
Psalm 22, it's verse 20 of Psalm 22. It says, deliver my soul from the sword. And in the movie, the rest of it is phrased, my darling from the power of the dog. Now, in modern translations, that darling is life. So it's translated to life. So it's deliver my soul from the sword, my life from the power of the dog. But darling is an interesting choice in that old translation that they show in the movie. But yeah.
So the idea like being delivered from something, I think that's in this. But I think as far as like the main theme is like, can you see, there's a scene where he looks at the hills and says, what do you see? There's several of these scenes. He asks people, what do you see? And then they flash to the hills all the time. What do you see? What do you see? What do you see? And I think there, without spoiling the movie, there's this sense of we see one thing that we want to see and we miss out on what's actually there. So I think the idea being is that we have a lot of assumptions. We have a lot of stereotypes that we play into. And we think things should go a certain way. We have patterns that we're used to. And what this movie has showed me is that we need to be more open to seeing what's in front of us in different interpretations of the same stuff. So like you have a totally look at the hill and you'll have different people have a different view of what's actually there. And so this movie's that way too.
Oh, that's beautiful. And even Phil, when he's talking to Peter and Peter sees the same thing that Phil sees, he points that out and he admires that.
So that when somebody can see the same thing against the grain, like most people aren't seeing the same thing. And it's like, oh, I see this. You go, oh, it was almost like he felt like somebody understood him.
Yeah.
So this mutuality of vision, I think, is there's something about. But I mean, as far as the theme of it, I think there is... I don't know. It's kind of like it's a psychological drama. It's about survival and suspense. And what do people do to survive? I mean, really, all the characters are trying to survive in some way or another. Mm-hmm. And they're in these, all of the main characters who got nominated are in these situations that are not who they are. And they're trying to figure out how are they going to make this work. And so they try all these different ways to make it work when they're not allowed to be who they are.
Yeah.
So it's not just as we look at the film, I think the temptation is to focus on characters who are hiding their sexuality. But in reality, everybody's hiding identity in the film.
Yeah. Everyone. And no one feels like they can be their true self.
If I only perform on the piano in this manner, I can be myself. But if that doesn't work out, I'll drink. You know, I mean, it's just like, so to a certain degree, everyone is just hiding or trying to find a way to deal with their, how the world is not aligning to who they are. And their relationships aren't.
It's powerful. It's good. So I really honed in on like the first part that you were talking about all the things going on under the surface. And I feel like that's what was really powerful for me is all the stuff that's hiding under that first impression, that first glance. Cause you know, when you take a character like Phil, you can so easily just write him off. Like at the beginning is cruel and misogynistic and toxic masculinity, of course, which is all those things. But in a way that only we can see, like he's so much more than that. I already mentioned that spot in the woods and Bronco Henry and that clothing and stuff. And even in that scene with the restaurant, when he mocks Peter for having like made these flowers, the camera zooms in on his like thumb, kind of almost like lovingly caressing, like he admires the craftsmanship, but he can't admit it. And he has to put on this front for the men, you know? Yeah. That's really interesting. And so I feel like there's all this stuff happening on the surface, and it reminds me of that line from one of my favorite movies of 2019 that I've talked about ad nauseum on this podcast, The Last Black Man in San Francisco. When Jimmy...
I love that movie.
I know. Yeah. I know. I'm sorry. Jimmy says, the main character of the movie says, people aren't one thing. That was the main line of that movie that I'll never forget. People aren't one thing. And I think it's really powerful and it's true. And we want everybody to be one thing because it's so much easier for our brain for everybody to be one thing. We have all these categories. And if I could just take you and go, boop, conservative or jerk or canceled, it's so much easier because it just reconciles the nuance and all the stuff that our brain hates, like, you know, three dimensions and areas and shades of gray. And so we just want everyone to fit into this one thing. And Phil isn't one thing. He's a terrible human being in a lot of ways, but he's also capable of actual genuine kindness and tenderness and love. And we see that with how his relationship forms with Peter. You know, he's this kind of homophobic bigot, and he's also gay. And so it just reminds me that our job as people is just to love, and that's it. And this is something that Greg Boyd, one of my favorite theologians, harps on all the time, is that like the original sin, whether you take it as a metaphor or a real thing in the Garden of Eden, like the original sin was Adam and Eve sort of taking the place of God. Eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was basically saying that I'm now going to sit in the seat of judgment, and I'm going to judge good and evil, and I'm going to say you're in and you're out and you're this and you're that, and that's God's job, Boyd says, and that our job is simply to love people because it's unconditional love that actually changes the world. And you see that with Peter too. Like when Phil changes, or when their dynamic changes, and when Phil kind of breaks through to that, when his crusty demeanor is broken, it's because Peter shows him unconditional love, and that one key scene towards the end there.
So like, I totally disagree with you on that. Okay. But not about the concept theologically. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I disagree with you on that relationship.
Okay. Like,
I think it's really, so, and we can't talk about it without spoiling the movie.
Let's talk about the ending, because I think we have to. And so let's go ahead and spoil what happens at the end. This is your spoiler alert. Go ahead, skip ahead a few minutes if you need to, if you don't want it to be spoiled. So let's talk about what happens at the end. So basically, you have this final scene where Peter and Phil are in the ranch, and Phil is braiding this rope for
rawhide
Peter.
Rope for roping.
Rawhide rope. And we find out basically later that this rawhide comes from this anthrax diseased animal that Peter grabbed on the countryside, and Phil uses it because all the rawhide has been sold by Rose. So basically you have this scene where he's sticking his hand in the water, and that's how he gets infected with anthrax, but that's in the process of making this rope for Peter, which is a kind gesture. And so I want to go back to what I was saying before, because you seem to disagree with it, where Peter to me shows unconditional kindness to Phil by offering this rawhide that Rose sold all the hide, and Peter and Phil's really upset about it, and Peter's like, I've got some and you can go ahead and use it. And that, like, we see like Phil's, you know, heart just totally melt in that moment, and they have this moment of tenderness where he's making the rope, they talk about Bronco Henry, and then they share a cigarette in this sort of sensual way of passing the cigarette back and forth, and that's how that ends. And of course then Phil ends up dying the next day. So what is your take on that scene? Go ahead.
So I have a couple takes. One is, I don't necessarily think that the kid is, we've seen his sexuality at all. Like, there's no indicator of that. Like, can you think of one?
I mean, no, outside of the stereotypes, which is
something. Are you seeing what you want to see?
Are we seeing what Phil sees? Right, exactly.
But I do think we've seen him be he does want the best life for his mother. He wants to be a physician. And we do know, because he tells us this, is that he is cold. Like, he doesn't feel like there's no emotion. He doesn't feel emotion necessarily. He's very calculated.
The way he dissects that rabbit that, you know, was like a loving pet. Right.
So like we look at, like, he makes those flowers and he really makes them for his father's grave. But his mom wants him to put them on the table to like liven up the place. But he's really replacing these flowers. So he doesn't have to replace the flowers every day if he makes these fake ones. So it's like he's doing his duty, but he's going to do it smarter. Okay. And then, like, the way he basically looks real carefully at everybody, figures out their strengths and their weaknesses very quickly, figures out their passions, and then he executes his plan in order to get what he wants, which for him sounds like he wants
I think he wants his mom to be happy, but I also think he wants to have like basically power and control.
So you're implying that Peter knew that the animal was diseased and purposefully infected Phil.
Or that when that opportunity came around, like he might have been, yeah, he did. And he knew, I mean, he puts the gloves on, he does all that. He has the rawhide ready to roll. You know, I think he got to the point where he's like, he could see an opportunity and he took it.
That's a really interesting perspective. I mean, it is true that we were kind of seeing what we want to see, right? I mean, we do see Peter, mm-hmm. you know, find the stash of male porn in the woods, but he doesn't mm-hmm. like it. There's really no indication that he gets into it. Right. Exactly. And that's interesting. I've never thought about
that. He just observes. He looks. Possibly that gives him here's my angle. And I'm going to play this angle perfectly. So he knows, mm-hmm. if he, you know, and it doesn't even matter at that point, like what his sexuality is for the plot. It's really like, how is he going to leverage what he knows about Phil?
Yeah.
And to get what he wants, which is he wants his mom to be happy and he wants to go to medical school. And it sounds like he's going to get a lot of money too. So like eventually he's going to be the heir of that ranch. Right.
Wow. And so, kind of changes the ending because at the end, the very last scene, we see him, you know, kind of with the rope that Phil made him. And then he reads that Bible verse, you know, basically deliver my life from the power of the dog. I mean, if you look at the context of Psalm 22, it's basically saying there's all these evildoers that are trying to attack me and basically deliver me from them. So what if that's what he did? What if he's now free from this man who was corrupting his mom and everything?
Right. So like Phil, you know, and I think the temptation is to like, okay, so because Phil is homosexual is to like say he's going to be the victim in this, right? Mm-hmm. Especially which he ends up being the victim in it. But Phil's also like just awful. Phil's just not a good dude.
Right. Like right.
He's a mean dude. And so this kid, it's like, it doesn't, he figures out kind of like, okay, well, if I can endear myself to him in some way, then I'll have more access to take him down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I look at it as being very calculated. And then I'm like, well, did he kill his father? What exactly happened here? Oh, like, what's going on here?
And wasn't like the opening
kid just a sociopath?
Wasn't the opening line of the movie that basically like my dad died and so it was my job to take care of my mom? And if you look at it from that perspective, I mean, Phil was mm-hmm. tormenting his mom every day and he wasn't going to stop. Like, I mean, that was a very toxic relationship.
So the kids seemed to have like a full, very cold, but a good understanding of what was actually happening there.
Wow.
And so
now you've totally like made me rethink the entire movie here. I think like, you know, Peter's kindness to Phil like melts his heart and they have this tender moment together. But like that actually makes a lot of sense in contrast to the whole thing. Yeah.
So what we saw was, oh, he's the rabbit. And they're like, no, he's the guy that dissected the rabbit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or how many timbers can you remove until the bunny will run?
Jeez. And then
yeah, I mean, like all that stuff is like
that goes with Greenwood's score, right? Suddenly, it's like that. Yeah, wow.
So I look at him as being he's very Machiavellian. He's going to get to his goal however he can, and he really does. He finds the person of power, convinces that person of who he is, and then very quickly takes that person out.
Jeez.
So I look at it as like, and then we didn't expect it. We expected, honestly, we expected Phil to like basically go into the woods and have sex with a kid. I mean, that's mm-hmm. like, right? I mean,
yeah.
isn't that
yeah,
like
yeah.
kind of like,
of course.
Well, like our eyes are like, oh, this is what's going to happen. That's not what happened at all. It's like flipped. It's like, yeah. no, this guy's not going to take advantage of the kid. The kid's going to murder this guy.
Jeez.
Right. I know.
This is why I love talking about movies with you, man, because it's like you just rock my world. I didn't see that at all. And now I want to go watch the movie again.
And it's difficult because like we see like you see this part of Phil. It's like, oh, he's nurturing. He's got this part of him. Like as soon as he thinks that the kid is gay, he's like, oh, I'm going to take care of this kid. It's going to be smooth sailing for you.
Right.
And he begins to see these parts of Phil that are like so full of love and care. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, well, okay, so is this, so it's almost like a big brother or a father figure that he doesn't have, but Phil never has that in mind. He's going to take this guy out from day one.
You mean Peter? Yeah, Peter.
Peter, that's what I mean. Phil, yeah. Phil thought he was going to like basically have a son, you know, right? I mean, that's what I'm looking at. Or
be the Bronco Henry to him basically. And
exactly like, hey, all right, here's the legacy. Here's how you're going to survive in this world that doesn't accept you. And which there's something that's endearing about that. And so we begin to like Phil a little bit.
But then it's basically like, it's like that scene where he brings home the rabbit, everybody's, it's in love with it. And then the next day the rabbit's splayed out, on the table. Everyone's like, what? It's like, there you go.
And he's doing it because he's autodidact. I mean, he's like an autodidact. So he's like teaching himself about anatomy via dissecting a rabbit. Mm-hmm. So it's very calculated and it makes total sense. So it follows 100%.
Whoo, there it is. You heard it here. The hot take. I love it. All right. Well, hey.
I might be seeing the wrong thing.
No, I don't think you are.
Hills.
I was seeing the wrong thing. I'm always like bringing it back to love and tenderness. And it's like, oh, okay, love changes the world. Love changed Phil. And it's like, you know what? I think you're right.
I don't know. I don't know how Phil was. I think he seemed more happy when he, as he was dying than before, but I don't know.
Yeah. All right. We got to wrap this one up. What are your overall thoughts on Power of the Dog, and give us your letter grade? What do you think of the movie overall?
I think it's a great movie. Tons of suspense. And I give it an A. I think it'll win. Look at the acting. Just the acting. Like if it was just like an okay plot, but the plot's amazing. Lots of twists. Uncomfortable movie. So you're not going to like come out of there being like, yeah, you're going to come out going,
yeah,
what happened? But some movies are that way. It's jarring.
Yeah.
What about you,
Tim? So this is so funny because like I was going to say like, and my initial take on the movie was that I was very disappointed in the third act. I thought that it really, it was masterful until that kind of like the last half hour-ish of the movie, like for a couple of reasons. One, I feel like there was a lot of threads that didn't really, that kind of died off. Like I feel like the Rose and George plot just like George like almost disappears from the movie like three-fourths of the way through, which is weird because he's like central to it before. And I then was really underwhelmed by the ending because I felt like, you have this moment with Peter and Phil and then you're expecting that's going to be the beginning of this chain reaction of some other scenes that take place, and then we're going to get to this big climactic somehow this thing that happens. Like I'm all about the climactic ending. We need a climax, especially when you got this music that's building up. It's like something's gonna happen. And I feel like in There Will Be Blood something happens, right? You've got Daniel Day-Lewis having the final showdown with Paul Dano in the bowling alley, and it's like, yeah, the music didn't lie, this was all headed to this moment. And so I was underwhelmed that it just basically just fizzles out with Phil dying within a minute and then the movie's over in like 5 minutes, and it's like, what happened? So I was going to, because of the ending, give it like honestly a B+, because you know how passionate I am about endings, and I don't care how perfect the movie is until that point. If you can't land the plane, we have a problem. And so that's why I always say you should start with an ending and go from there. But all of that to say, your interpretation of the movie like changes everything for me. And if you're right, then that moment between Peter and Phil is an appropriate climax, because it's kind of like Peter laying in the scorpion stinger, and that sort of matches up with everything else that happened. And then that ending on the bed where he looks at the rope, which I thought was like an endearing thing. He kind of stuffs it under the bed. Now it feels like kind of like took care of that. And his mom and George outside the window are happy now, which is like the whole goal all along. So I feel like if I watch the movie again in that context, it really all does come together. And so I'm tempted to change my grade to more in the lines of in the A range. So dang, you did it.
Yeah, it's pretty intense stuff. If that interpretation holds, which I don't know if it does. I mean, this is the first time you and I were just talking about it. I didn't read any reviews.
Yeah.
If it doesn't go that interpretation, you're right. It does fall short.
All right. Well, yeah, I'm officially changing my letter grade to an A- for now, and it could be even higher. I'm going to watch it again with that perspective in mind, but there you go. This is why we watch films in community, people. We don't watch them by ourselves, because then we need other perspectives.
I bet you that there's a third perspective.
I'm sure.
That is going to help us both. Like, because I think about this all the time. Like, I feel like I missed a lot of stuff in the film, even though I watched it twice. I feel like I missed a ton. And I bet somebody who's listening will have seen something that we didn't.
Yeah.
And it's going to go, well, this is what I think about it. And here's where And that would be, to me, it'd be very interesting. That's happened before, too, when we've done reviews.
Absolutely. And that is why our communication lines are always open. You can always send us an email at podcast@cinemafaith.com. Once again, podcast@cinemafaith.com. You can tell us why we're wrong, why our perspective is off the mark. And you can tell us about that third one that maybe will change both of our worlds.
We're like, what? What? It was the rabbit all along?
It was the rabbit.
Awesome. It was a horse?
Well, that's it. Well, there you have it. That is it. That is our long-awaited return to podcasting, Tim. Probably a little bit longer than our listeners are used to, but come on. I mean, like, it's been 2 years. Like, you missed us, right? You missed us.
I hope they missed us. Maybe
they're gone, Tim. No, three people listen to this, two of which are our wives. It's fine.
No, my wife doesn't listen.
All right. Dan Baker and my wife.
Yeah. Oh, excellent.
There you go.
All right. Perfect. Well, maybe Dan Baker will have a take. We'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. All right. So the movie is The Power of the Dog. It is on Netflix. You can go watch it right now and come back and listen to our take and tell us yours. And now we got to figure out what to review next. So I don't know. I mean, Tim, I know you hate this stuff, but there is a Batman movie coming out at the beginning of March with Paul Dano as the Riddler. Speaking of There Will Be Blood. I don't know. I haven't researched yet, so we'll see. We'll keep that on the back burner as a possibility, but we'll pick something, and we will try to be back next month, and there you go. Well, Tim, it's great to be back. We'll see how this goes, and just love talking movies with you, man, always.
Definitely.
All right, keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.